This is the session entitled The Bible and Politics. I'm Paul Hansen. It is August 12, 1991, and the title of our first session is The United States, God's Chosen Nation. And I thought it'd be helpful if you just knew a little bit what I intend to do. We're kind of broaching the topic of religion and politics today by asking this question of our own nation, knowing full well that it often has been and still is identified in that way as God's chosen people in the world. Certainly that is a way of raising the question of the role of the Bible in politics. With apologies to people from Great Britain and Canada and Australia, but not really, because a lot of the political ferment that continues to exercise us in this country, of course, is derived from Hume and Locke and some of these Rousseau, these wonderful thinkers from across the ocean. And certainly Canada and Australia share analogous problems to our own. So I think you will all feel that you're part of the discussion, though illustrations will often be drawn from our country's history, that is say U.S. history. After broaching the topic of religion and politics in that manner by looking back at the history of our own country, we're going to, of necessity, address the question tomorrow of the use and misuse of the Bible. What restraints are there from this kind of just willy-nilly application of the Bible to defend most any ideology or position whatsoever? Is there anything objective about this whole problem of religion and politics? Then we're going to take an excursion into the Bible, because the Bible is, in a real sense, a political document. And we'll see that there are, indeed, several different political models present there, ways of relating religion to the civil and political realm. And, indeed, those five in number, as I count them, have been influential among different groups at different times. So it's helpful just to see where these different options came from, preparing us finally on Friday, there are two of those biblical sessions, on Friday then, to go back to the question to see whether we can make some constructive, helpful statements that can guide us to relating our Christian faith as a biblically based faith to our political engagement. Okay, so today, the United States, God's chosen nation. We, of course, inevitably draw from the First Amendment tradition when we raise this question. For those of you that, like me, have to look it up to remember what it says, the First Amendment reads, "Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof." Now, we'll be coming back and back to that First Amendment tradition because it is an ingenious one. And it's ingenious because of the way it balances religion and civil citizenship on the one hand, and in the ambiguity that it embeds in that very statement on the other. Of course, that making possible a lot of flexibility as the nation changes and time changes. The ambiguity can be illustrated already by contrasting Thomas Jefferson's definition with James Madison. For Thomas Jefferson, it was a wall of separation. There was to be no fiddling around on the part of religious groups in the government or vice versa, whereas James Madison spoke more of a line of separation. To go on with his definition, line of separation between the rights of religion and the civil authority. And indeed, that has characterized the long series of Supreme Court decisions when it came to issues of religion and politics. A great deal of latitude, a possibility of religious communities influencing government, the safeguard much more on the other side of government not being allowed to make incursions into the freedom of either individual or corporate worship. Now, I would like from the very beginning, though, to make the topic one that relates to you concretely, and I'm going to do that by simply asking this question. What are some of the issues that come to your mind when you think of the relationship between religious communities and government? What are some of the issues that occupy that ambiguous area between responsibilities of civil authority and religious communities?
Abortion.
Oh, of course. Abortion's a major one. right now. And we'll have occasion, I'm sure, to come back to that and other issues. What are other ones now?
Prayers in school
keeps emerging.
Taxation.
Taxation, okay.
Censorship.
Social welfare.
Social welfare.
Right to die.
Right to die.
Defense spending.
Draft. And there have been civil court cases in almost all of these realms, and I'm sure we'll continue to see them. So already, just by that litany, I think we've illustrated very definitely that this is a topic, if we're going to be responsible citizens and if we're going to be responsible Christians, that must be addressed. In the Evangelical Lutheran Church of America, the controversy rages. Nancy, our program director, and I first became acquainted as a result of sitting for long sessions in Chicago trying to hammer out a foundational social statement for the new church. And no sooner had the preliminary drafts. How many have seen some of the versions of that? Nancy here? Be encouraged, Nancy. This stuff really gets out to the people in the church. But at any rate, it wasn't long before certain people started writing letters asking what right the church had to meddle in politics in this fashion. And, of course, one of the primary spokesperson, and I'm not setting up bad guys and good guys, because this is a legitimate discussion. Richard John Newhouse was, as recently as last summer, at a conference at St. Olaf, vociferous in his condemnation of the Division for Church and Society for writing this foundational statement, which, if you haven't seen, I hope you'll see me after the session, because it'll go before the Assembly next summer for voting. And so it is also a question that vexes the church today. To what degree can the church as church address political topics such as the ones that we just raised? We can illustrate very quickly that this topic is an existential one. It is occupying the thoughts of politicians and devout Christians every day. It's not just our ancient Lutheran tradition and Calvinist tradition and the continent that continues to be occupied with this problem. In Germany today, I don't think you'll ever find a German flag flying in a church. And the reason is because Hitler and some of the Führer and some of the Kaisers before that were able to claim that there was a wedding between the church and the government. And of course, we know the very bitter fruits of that way of relating church and state. But is the wall of separation, as defined by Thomas Jefferson, the answer? I think that quickly one could find illustrations in our country to say that we would hate to see the separation that complete. Can someone think of a positive example, almost an irrefutable example, of the gain to be gotten from the involvement of churches in political matters?
Slavery issue.
Well, I asked for one, I got one. Civil rights as a continuation of that. And of course, we could come up with others. But let's stop there because it'll get more controversial as we take positions on abortion and the like. But certainly in the case of slavery and civil rights, a few would deny the fact that religious communities played a very important constructive role. Then on the other hand, you sometimes wonder about the engagement on these two sides. Ronald Reagan was interviewed by an Israeli correspondent, actually from the Jerusalem Post. There's always potential embarrassment to be gotten from that situation. And in this case, he was asked about certain events that were going on in the Middle East, and he started pointing his finger and started instructing the Jerusalem Post reporter because this person was not, in Reagan's mind, sensitive enough to knowledge that Ronald Reagan had of biblical issues. He says, "Do you not know what your prophets say about Armageddon and that these events here very well may be fulfilled in our own day?" So here's apparently someone that was guided in his own political decision-making on the basis of certain prophecies about the end of the world, which he felt perhaps are happening in our day. And James Watt made certain decisions about which forests should be sold on the basis of that same type of religious ideology. So we may feel that some of these people are pure politicians. They are steeped with theologies that are assisting them in making political decisions. Well, more recently, George Bush went to his Anglican, his Episcopal bishop, to get advice on the Gulf crisis. And it was very interesting. He didn't keep him around very long, but called Billy Graham in on January 14th. And Billy Graham, I don't know if they actually slept together or he was in the same bedroom, but he was in the White House on the night of the critical decision. We know from the basis of Billy Graham's theology and political theology what he told him. And George Bush, right or wrong, his decision, certainly received specific political advice from an evangelical leader in our country. Just illustrations that church and politics are very much intertwined in this country, but willy-nilly, usually without the ability of either side to explain what kind of overall theological position or political position is guiding this interplay. During the Gulf crisis, I got more calls from the media to comment and to relate biblical theology to the contemporary situation than at any other time in my career. I was even on television. And boy, for an Old Testament scholar, that's really a high point. But the common question was, what light do the prophecies in Daniel, in the book of Revelation, shed on the events in the Gulf? Now, when we had all this terrible stuff going on in Nicaragua, I didn't receive a single call because of the geography. No, this was happening very close to where the end time scenario would be carried out. So we started getting the phone calls. And some of you know that this is an old genre, Hal Lindsey, but far behind him, late great Planet Earth, the countdown, which we can now identify with contemporary events. And I won't go into that because you're all too familiar, but the difference between Hal Lindsey's first edition, and now it's in its about 28th and 2-3 million copies and all that, the difference between that first edition and our contemporary religious scene is that the that element is becoming much more politically active and effective, if you think of Pat Robertson and Jerry Falwell. So we may sit around as mainstream Protestants and say wall of separation,
right,
but we're creating a vacuum that's very, very readily being filled. So I think we better get off of our duffs and start addressing the topic. Okay, I'm going to offer as a given then and see if there's anyone that dissents. Religion influences politics in the United States, and it always has. The mandate then is to develop a responsible form of engagement between these two sides, and that'll be our challenge. Moreover, I think it's fair to say, and we can't dump too much on the religious right, that any society that lacks a strong moral foundation is a very unstable society. The Greek and Roman philosophers already argued that. We don't require Robert Bella to come along and say that that is a necessity. Indeed, all of our founding fathers, including Thomas Jefferson, argued that for a republic to exist, you had to have a people who were educated morally by the Christian Church. They felt that was the only source of building the moral fiber that was required by any republic, that is, that one that depends on an educated public and a moral public for its very existence. Now, I want to ask another question before we get into this little retrospect into our own nation's history. What's the health of our nation? What's the nature of its moral foundation? Do you see certain developments, issues that cause alarm when it comes to the question of the health of the nation? What are some of the issues that really bother you most, long-term, fundamental issues, as they are afflicting our nation and perhaps even undercutting its viability as a culture?
The culture of violence. That
is violence. It's just incredible.
It's an endemic culture of violence.
There are war zones that we have constructed in our cities that you don't dare enter if you are this type of person or that, okay?
Pornography.
Just, there seems to be no, you know, immediately then again you get, but how about freedom of expression, freedom of the press? But what's just alarming is this vacuum again that anything goes. You know, I don't want censorship, but boy, it would be wonderful if when absolute trash were published, that it wouldn't be purchased, making those who publish it wealthy. That's the kind of self-governing that you would like. Other signs? Oh, wow. You know, statistically in the last 10 years, home ownership, you know, falling out of the reach of more and more people. Just the demographics of that demonstrated beyond all doubt. Okay? Education. Yeah, two education systems at least in this country, perhaps three, but you know, if you go to certain schools, a very, very different quality of education than if you happen to go to another, urban versus suburban, for example. Well, already, that's plenty. You know, if we could solve just those, it would be very, very helpful. But that takes a very clear-minded set of priorities, and what informs them? What creates the moral fiber of a nation? What provides its moral foundation? And it's very hard to let churches off the hook on that one, because if they don't provide that education, you look, I think, in vain when it comes to mass education for a substitute. Well, you've done a good job. So now I'm going to, first of all, in looking at our country, begin by a critic from the outside, and that is one whom we've come to admire greatly, Václav Havel, the president of Czechoslovakia. He describes the secularization that he sees occurring in the world, in the various nations, in these terms. We have become morally ill because we are used to saying one thing and thinking another. We have learned not to believe in anything, not to care about each other, to worry only about ourselves. The concepts of love, friendship, mercy, humility, and forgiveness have lost their depths and dimensions, and for many of us, they represent only some sort of psychological curiosity, or they appear as long-lost wanderers from faraway times, somewhat ludicrous in the era of computers and spaceships. Now, what's remarkable there is his list of virtues. You know, they're the simplest. They're the most fundamental biblical truths. And yet, this remarkable playwright-turned-politician identifies these as the foundation stones of a viable nation. So, in the wake of a quotation like that, who could claim that the church is innocent when it comes to the development that we see on all sides in our culture? We're indicted, and I believe we're even already declared guilty. Before we turn to the original shapers of our own government to see how they use the Bible, it might be interesting to kind of cast up in front of our eyes a typology of different models that we'll find in the Bible. Remember, we'll do that on days 3 and 4. But it's helpful to keep in mind that the longest span of Christendom utilized one model from the Bible. It was the balancing of church and monarchy, with the insistence on the part of the church that it have the ultimate say in determining realities of the world up through medieval times. And this is one that you can find in the Bible. However, the Reformation introduced a kind of a ferment that led to three other alternatives. Luther drew from St. Augustine a particular model of division between church and state that nevertheless invested in the church a kind of a critical position which had to acknowledge the autonomy of civil authority, but at the same time had to engage in criticizing that authority. Calvin went for a purer model, namely a theocratic model, which is also very biblically based. Luther's, I'll argue, is derived from the prophets. Calvin's from the period of the judges. And it was the claim that God rules directly over the Geneva or the nation or the state through religious leaders. So that's a theocratic model. Then we have the radical reformers, who, because of being burned — Menno Simons couldn't comment much anymore on his being burned, but the others, metaphorically burned, began to develop a sectarian model of withdrawal, in which communities of faith were to separate themselves from the tainted structures of government in order to maintain a pure realm of the spirit. So those are three models that grew out of the reaction of the reformers against the old medieval model of the monarchy. When it comes to our country, which of these models is the most influential? Just think, the theocratic
expect the last one.
It is the last one, perhaps, if we get into our modern days. But think of the earliest stages of our country, the theocratic right. And it's an interesting historical accident. I don't know what God was doing there, certainly not listening to Lutheran prayers at the beginning of our government. Because the reason our model under the Puritans is the theocratic model is the result of an historical accident. Remember the Catholic Queen Mary persecuting the Protestants in England and their mass flights towards the continent. Quite naturally, many of these would have gone to Germany because there were close ties, even in terms of royal marriage. But they couldn't go to Germany because the German Lutherans and the Catholics were at war with one another. And so no one in his or her right mind would migrate to Germany. So they went to peaceful Geneva. And they fell under the spell of Calvin's theocratic model. They went back to England when they were able, and there these Puritans brought this idea of the pure state, which would be fully under the rule of God. But of course, because of the Anglican Church, they had mixed results there. It was only when they came to this country, this native realm, that they were able to create the city on the hill. Remember John Winthrop's speech aboard the Arbella. Governor William Winthrop reformulated this concept by paraphrasing Deuteronomy 26. He said, "May not and ought not the children of these fathers rightly say, our fathers were Englishmen which came over this great ocean and were ready to perish in this wilderness, but they cried unto the Lord, and he heard their voice and looked on their adversity." They felt in their deepest marrow of their bones that they were the new Israel and that God had brought them here with a purpose, namely to establish the pure theocracy, the people of God. So they set out with holy zeal to establish this pure nation. And their religious convictions gave them both perseverance to overcome tremendous obstacles and a high degree of intolerance when it came to anyone who dissented. But dissent, very interestingly, was productive of its own experiment. And that was the minority position. You know, that you're right is very, very important when you think of the founding of Rhode Island, of Roger Williams' experiment, William Penn in England, Jonathan Edwards, though working within the congregational tradition, very, very astutely formulated that second model, the model of separation but engagement. And I find Ezra Stiles in 1772 perhaps formulating this most eloquently of all. Just think whether this could be a model to guide you're relating your Christian faith to the issues that we just mentioned. Ezra Stiles in 1772 said, "I am a friend to American liberty, but we have another department, being called to an office and work which may be successfully pursued under every species of civil tyranny or liberty. We cannot become the dupes of politicians without alliances, concessions, and connections dangerous to evangelical truth and spiritual liberty." Now, how many politicians in the Vietnam era were able to be that astute in distinguishing between democracy and God's truth? How many were able to say that we are called to an office and a work, that is to say, as Christians engage in politics, which may be successfully pursued under every species of government, every ideology? Well, we had some very astute thinking in the early history of our country, and that is that second model that was dissenting from the dominant Puritan one. Now, those of us that do have some roots in Lutheranism can begin to get very interested in this dissenting option, because as we'll see on Friday, and maybe I'll not be able to resist mentioning from time to time, even in the Old Testament, there are roots to the two kingdoms theory. And I think that's the Lutheran hidden tradition that we better get on the ball to bring into the political discourse, or we're not being responsible to our Calvinistic brothers who stand and sisters who stand so sorely in need of our light. No, I don't mean that. So we move into the revolutionary period. And unfortunately, that subtle dissenting position was completely lost. And why was it lost? Because of the fervor of war. because of patriotism, which leads everyone to jump on the bandwagon and leads those that are on the bandwagon to point to those that dissent as unpatriotic. And, you know, what greater sin in this country than being critical, I mean, being unpatriotic? So we have the banner carried into the Revolutionary War being the theocratic one. Few of the preachers of the Great Awakening were able to do what Jonathan Edwards did, and I wish we could dwell on him for a while, because he did maintain that distinction between the state and God's reign. But his Augustinian category of common grace that permitted Christians to work together with the unregenerate for justice and civil order completely passed these more fervent theologians by. In other words, in Augustine and Jonathan Edwards, you had this, you know, kind of a natural theology substratum that said, well, they may not be saved, but they're good partners in working politically for justice and order, which God also desires for God's people. No, instead you had the triumphalistic theocratic model completely taking over. Evangelical passion for spiritual purity was translated directly into passion for this perfect nation. Of course, one of the victims was King George. I mean, King George wasn't all that bad. I mean, these taxes and this tea business, that's ridiculous stuff. He was providing all kinds of services, and doesn't he deserve his little tax on his tea, Earl Grey or whatever it was? But what happened was, any attack on the rights of these colonies immediately was equated with cardinal sin. And the pragmatics of political compromise were ruled out as quickly as compromise with the devil was excluded in spiritual matters. King George was identified with the Antichrist. And God's plan for the emerging republic came to be regarded as the key to God's plan for the world, yes, indeed, for the entire universe. We find, for example, Robert Smith, a good Presbyterian in 1781, declare that the cause of America is the cause of Christ. So we have the war preparations fed with a millennialistic worldview that left no gray areas, only children of light and children of darkness. When Ethan Allen, for example, brought his troops to Fort Ticonderoga, he proclaimed the victory, quote, in the name of the great Jehovah and the Continental Congress. No problem with the parallelism, right? In 1784, the New England Baptist Association could conclude, quote, nor is it at all improbable that America is reserved in the mind of Jehovah to be the grand theater on which the divine Redeemer will accomplish glorious things. If we observe the signs of the times, we shall find reason to think he is on his way. So we were on our way. Revisionist theologians, of course, are quick to note the adverse effects of this kind of theocratic model. And we could go into them. And it would be tempting to go into them. And when I finally publish this, I will go into them. But I've learned that good sermons don't dwell on the negative, because you never get to the positive. There's so damn much negativity around. But there are plenty of victims of self-righteous repression of dissent, the Native Americans. Wherever these settlers went, 80% were the immediate victims of this righteous new kingdom. And frightening indeed is the thought that patriotic Christianity conceivably could have provided the substance for the founding documents. Now, that's a funny statement. Rue the thought that the most Christian of all political models could have become the basis of our founding documents, that the purest application of the gospel could have been what guided our founding fathers. Isn't that a strange statement for a Christian to make? But I mean it. Another stream, thank God, asserted itself. That stream, flowing strongly through the Whig Party, traces its roots to that godless enlightenment that removed the simple presence of God and instead pointed to that machine maker up there who set it all in motion. And so we have what's translated into the founding documents coming from political philosophers like Hume and Locke. In the thought of the deists like Jefferson and Franklin, there was no room for the notion of a personal deity who would pick out one nation as favorite over all of the others. Problems of international conflict and constitutional ordering had to be solved by the application of sound reason. And for God, may seem very strange again, and you may very well, I can see on many of your faces, you are thinking, I'm now not the one who would assert that in God's eyes we are the chosen nation, but indeed I am the raving, godless Harvard theologian. But now wait a minute, because I think as Lutherans, as well as Catholics, Presbyterians, Methodists, and Anglicans, what we can see in this strange twist towards the deists, away from the more passionate, millennialistic Calvinist theologians, the operation of the left hand of God. Now, I think that's a category that can rescue us out of this situation. Because God, in my mind, was active in the work of the framers of our Constitution, for though not without weaknesses, the structure of relationships that they established within the branches of government and between government and the churches of the country became a very suitable context for the working out of differences between a plurality of religious groups and the different political ideologies that fed into this burgeoning nation. In other words, we find here in these deists the position of the referee, the umpire between these different conflicting religious groups. And what is the Constitution and the Bill of Rights, the amendments? What are these documents if not the rules of a game? And rules cannot be partial to one theology or one religion over the other if you're going to have a genuinely pluralistic country. So I find the left hand of God certainly contributed, the deists, to the process of writing the Constitution. The influence of John Locke, for example, is unmistakable in the sober anthropology that informed the thinking of the framers of the founding documents. They regarded the human in the natural state as a warring animal and looked upon the corruption of power as a threat to civilized society. Very well that they did, because that meant they were realistic in setting up the checks and balances. James Madison could have just finished reading words, my favorite words actually, in Jeremiah, from Jeremiah 17:9. The heart is deceitful above all things and desperately corrupt. Who can understand it? He could have just have finished reading those words when he wrote in the 10th Federalist his description of, quote, the flames of factionalism, fanned by the impulse of passion or of interest, adverse to the rights of other citizens or to the permanent and aggregate interests of community, and then located all this sordid, terrible stuff in, quote, the nature of man. So this is the deist mentality operating here. They're sober about the possibilities of a nation and trying to construct a framework within which decency and order could be worked out. So it was distrust of natural human propensities that fostered opposition to the idea of a state church. No human institution, and these deists regarded every church as a human institution, and Luther would agree with that because we're talking about not the invisible church here. They regarded these as not to be trusted. The government could not be wedded with any one of these because they were also influenced by human corruption. But it also reinforced the conviction that the virtuous citizenry that was required of a viable nation needed some kind of religious education in order to oppose this kind of bestial nature of humanity, and so they did at the same time call for a role of the churches in the formation of public morality. So you see the kind of rather subtle balancing that is in their thinking. Franklin wrote, "History will afford frequent opportunities of showing the necessity of a public religion. From its usefulness to the public, the advantage of a religious character among private persons, the mischiefs of superstition, etc., and the excellency of the Christian religion, above all others, ancient or modern." And even George Washington in his farewell address said, "Whatever may be conceded to the influence of refined education on minds of peculiar structure, reason, and experience, both forbid us to expect that national morality can prevail in exclusion of religious principle. And on, all these founding fathers said the Christian church must create public morality. Again, the source of such thinking is clear. Montesquieu had written in 1748, "He who has no religion at all is that terrible animal who can only feel his freedom when he is destroying and devouring." The result, then, of this deist thinking, informed as well by the French philosophers, was the First Amendment tradition, balancing the prescription of the establishment of religion with protection of the free exercise thereof, never according ultimate authority to any religious group in civil matters, but at the same time assuring that every religious group be able to exercise its influence and carry out its life of worship and community unthwarted by government. This formula, in a word, is ideally suited for the purposes of the church in relation to the public realm. It acknowledged that while interdependent, church and state are responsible for two distinct dimensions of human existence, and the two should not be confused. Without the protection of strong government, the freedom of religious bodies could be threatened. Without the contribution to moral education and personal virtue of the churches, government would be impossible. A healthy mutual respect was thus to characterize these separate but interacting bodies within society. In cases where Christian groups have collided with the First Amendment, it's usually not been the government's fault. It has been the special pleading of particular religious groups that their attitude towards this moral issue or that religious issue should take precedence over the attitudes of other religious groups. In other words, a violation of the rights, the religious rights guaranteed by the First Amendment for every single group. And so usually in these conflicts, the culprits have been the religious communities. The First Amendment, then, is a structural key to every conscientious effort that Christians might make to try to contribute to the strengthening of the moral foundation of this country. Again, the Constitution is not, or the amendments are not, positive contents in building this morality. They serve an umpire function. What they say, in effect, that the rules in this game are not to be drawn by direct appeal to divine authority. The rules are governed by reason. And in this game, in this stadium of moral discourse, every religious group and every religious individual is an equally legitimate player. No special pleading allowed. The Supreme Court, in dealing with various cases, has illustrated how effective this can be and how much freedom is given to religious groups and individuals to influence government. Now, you may disagree with the Bowen versus Kendrick decision of 1988, but it defended federal funding of church-sponsored sex counseling clinics because of the fact that this was regarded as something, if distributed even-handedly, contributed to the moral strength of the nation. And indeed, as Christopher Mooney, in a wonderful book, a Catholic natural theologian lawyer, has shown, the history of Supreme Court decisions, almost without fail, have sided with the rights of religious bodies to influence government. In other words, again, line of separation rather than the wall. If this is the case, then, we find that churches have a wonderful opportunity to clarify the role of church in the political realm in influencing politics. What we're going to do now, though, is move quickly to the 19th century after looking at our founding period and find how completely the churches of that time failed to meet this challenge. The 19th century was the century creating the notion of Christian America. And indeed, towards the end of that century, we have the publication, The Christian Century, claiming that within the 19th century, or was it looking to the 20th? In the 20th century, the world would be conquered completely for Christ. It was the century in which presidents like John Adams and industrialists like Andrew Carnegie were Christian saints in the view of most Christians. And indeed, they would vie with one another in being super patriots. It was the century that saw John L. O'Sullivan of the New York Morning News coin the phrase that we almost come to identify with biblical language, manifest destiny. On Independence Day in 1837, John Adams gave expression to the national cult creed. I quote from that speech, "Is it not that in the chain of human events, the birthday of the nation is indissoluble linked with the birthday of the Savior? That it forms a leading event in the progress of gospel dispensation? Is it not that the Declaration of Independence first organized the social compact on the foundation of the Redeemer's mission upon the earth?" The churches, from their side, reciprocated with this kind of political rhetoric. Lyman Beecher went about the nation recruiting clergy who would, quote, "help the nation develop institutions of homogeneous influence that would cultivate a sameness of views and feelings and interests which would lay the foundation of our empire upon a rock." In so doing, he felt that this was a foundation not provided by humans, but directly by God. Our own republic, in its constitutions and laws, is of heavenly origin. It was not borrowed from Greece or Rome, but from the Bible. Now, that's what Jerry Falwell will say, but again, factually and historically, that doesn't quite hold up. Horace Bushnell pulled all stops as he trumpeted his strident postmillennialism for the 19th century. "The wilderness shall bud and blossom as the rose before us, and we will not cease till a Christian nation throws up its temples of worship on every hill and plain, till knowledge, virtue, and religion, blending their dignity and their powerful power, have filled our great country with a manly and happy race of people, and the bonds of a complete Christian commonwealth are seen to span the continent." This no longer was just some kind of programmatic statement. This was a battle cry. And it's interesting to see that it had to be a battle cry because there were threats looming to Bushnell's manly and human race. And what were some of those threats appearing on the scene? You have to picture now Lyman Beecher's call to the homogeneous society with what was happening in the mid-19th century. And what was that? The immigration. And so here come the Jews and the Roman Catholics and, few Muslims even. And so this becomes a battle cry. And we know that the history of the 19th century is a history of repression, a history of disallowing the rights guaranteed by the Constitution to those who fell out of this very tightly woven safety net. And so the victims are many. We find that Christian America would prevail in this battle because, again to go on with Bushnell, we are the depositories of that light which is to illuminate the world. At the same time, Christianity had become wed with the growing empire as trade began to span the entire world, and often the missionaries followed on the coattails of the imperialistic and military expansionists. And middle-class America, for the most part, was cajoled into going along with this adventurism, this American imperialism of the 19th century. It had material benefits. But the main reason, I think, was this religious fervor that I knew so well from my father, who changed his name from Hans Hansen as he emigrated to William Hansen, and to the great articles that appeared upon the century celebration of the first Swedes in Minnesota. They were the super patriots. And so the problem with being critical for, as a Christian of this kind of creeping imperialism, with all of the sordid ills that it was sowing abroad and in this country, was the threat that you would be named unpatriotic. And as an immigrant, you couldn't afford that because, you know, your own existence was fairly fragile. So we have this most heinous of all sins, unpatriotism, eschewed by these people. And so you have a purchasing by some of the big industrialists
of the mainstream America and of Protestantism in general. The third reason for the collapse of any prophetic critique among the Protestant churches was the conversion of Christianity into personalism. And a lot of the evangelical movements of that time contributed to this. The gospel ceased to have principles of universal justice built into it, and it was personal salvation that these preachers were after. The results of this domestication of Christianity then were far-reaching. Those marching in God's favored army towards their universal destiny didn't have time to worry about those who lived out their instruments as menial helpers in the cause, slaves, recent immigrants, Native Americans, and the suppliers of precious commodities from all over the world. They were all instruments in God's great experiment. In the increasing tension between labor and management, we see the results, you know, the influence of the church in a lot of the early labor disputes, and they were all on one side practically. The silence of the church in the face of the creeping poverty of the urban cities. James Russell Lowell put it very well, I think, when he was pointing to one problem, the treatment of the black American. He charged that the American Tract Society members remain unmoved by the plight of black slaves, quote, provided only they could save the soul of Sambo alive by presenting him a pamphlet which he could not read. So that's maybe a caricature, but this is a very, very dominant trend throughout the 19th century. The 19th century, then, really represents one of the real deep enigmas of church history. This was the nation that set out to be the most Christian of all nations. Its self-image was totally informed by the Bible. Look at the terms that recur constantly. Promised land, chosen people, redeemer nation, new Israel, city on a hill, light of the world, kingdom of heaven. And the national epic that emerged equated George Washington with Moses, and on and on. But when one looks below the surface of these profuse references to the Almighty God, Jesus Christ, the Sermon on the Mount, Kingdom of Heaven, one finds a very disturbing biblical image. On the surface, a claim to be God's chosen people, but on the deeper side, a people such as that accused by the prophet Amos of having wedded sanctuary with the kingdom. And that is not, of course, God's kingdom, but the kingdom of the earthly monarch. Amos came to Amaziah. Amaziah came to Amos and said, get out of here. Don't preach here any longer. He was in Bethel, which was one of the two chief cults of the nation, of the kingdom. Get out of here. Don't preach here any longer, because this sanctuary is the sanctuary of the kingdom. It's the national shrine. And so what we can see theologically, looking at the Bible, not now in a superficial way of applying some of its phrases, but dynamically looking at its core, is a transformation of America into an idol. Unquestioned, untouched by the criticism of the church, because it was identified with God's kingdom. The social gospel movement made a protest and indeed tried to widen the gospel to deal with social ills. But you can see in Josiah Strong, one of the major social gospelists, how they too were co-opted by this patriotism. In 1893 he wrote, in this era mankind is to come more and more under Anglo-Saxon influence, and Anglo-Saxon civilization is more favorable than any other to the spread of those principles whose universal triumph is necessary to that perfection of the race to which it is destined, the entire realization of which will be the kingdom of heaven fully come to earth. Now, I think we can leave it at that. There's much more illustration of this perversion of the gospel into a national patriotism, ending, ironically, 1900 with Burbridge's speech to the Congress, arguing for the intervention of the United States in the Filipino Revolution on the basis of the United States being God's chosen people to all the benighted races of the world, to be, bring the light of the Anglo-Saxon Christian world to all parts. But, you know, we don't need to go on and on because I think the illustration is made. I want to ask a question now. What is wrong with that position, this manifest destiny position, that we have a chosen responsibility to domesticate, to enlighten the world, which is caught up in sin, as Joshua conquered Canaan and supplanted those godless people with a godless nation? Now, what's wrong with that biblical paradigm as applied by the Puritans?
That we are chosen because we are so good.
Mm-hmm. There's something wrong with that?
No, we are chosen for those people at all.
Yeah, and maybe we're not that damn good, right? And maybe God will use us in spite of that fact. But
it comes to the theology of glory for onward Christian soldiers and the warlike God.
Okay, so that I think is a very, very compact but complete answer. You know, it is a question of idolatry. Now, I want to, though, you know, we got a long ways to go to Friday when we can start putting some of this stuff together, but I want to anticipate Friday because the question should be real to us as we ask it. How is this any different from what we experienced in the Gulf War? In terms of criteriology, and this isn't to ask at the moment whether the Gulf War was right or wrong. What I mean is the tools that we applied to determine what we were going to do and that we now use to assess what was done there. Why did we intervene there, do you think?
Oil.
Okay, and what right do we have to say anything about the oil in that area?
Well, we depended on that oil in that area.
But why do we depend on that oil in that area?
Because of our lifestyle.
Right, again. So why were we so silent? It was very difficult to speak out at that time. And the danger is that whenever you have a war situation, in other words, precisely at the point where a Christian witness is most sorely needed, it becomes most difficult for Christians to speak out. You know, it's just like the Revolutionary War period. To speak out is to be unpatriotic. Yeah.
So I think it was in one way easier to go after Saddam Hussein.
Yeah.
Because he didn't look left and right.
Yeah, there's no question. There's racism involved in that. And of course, look at the two theaters in World War II. You know, where do we drop the bombs?
Right.
Yep.
Well, my daughter did speak out against the war in her little school. And what she got a lot back from school was that Vietnam era stuff came out.
Uh-huh.
And those people that had come back and been in the Vietnam War felt that that anger raised up that you were being unpatriotic.
Yeah.
By not supporting this. And I couldn't believe that 20 years they were still holding it, that they got sin at coming back from that Vietnam War.
Yeah, yeah, and we needed
to. So you need to support these soldiers, you need to put up the yellow ribbon, and it got into this patriotic fervor again.
Yeah. What really alarms me about that whole thing is the naivete, our lack of resources to deal with these issues. Let's try to look at that. Why is that? And again, I would be surprised if there aren't some people who would have a very well thought out idea of why we had to intervene. And I'll probably shock you, but I think we had to. What alarms me is that it was impossible to raise questions about it. In other words, we somehow don't have a foundation for doing that. Why is that?
Well, I think part of it has to do with where the forum has been shifted to for any type of discourse. You know, a lot of it is in the television, you know, and the larger papers. You know, the Associated Press and the UPI, you know, all they're just going to add all the little papers, I'm talking New York Times, you know, big papers, that forum being controlled is enough to control the whole. I mean, to say that there wasn't, to say where were we, why weren't we speaking out? You know, when I looked around me, we didn't have a television during that period, and as I looked around me, I saw a lot of people speaking out against the war, a lot of people doing a lot of things.
Uh-huh.
And then when I would sit down in front of television, that was, I was
it's a big, big problem, and you know, Exactly.
Not what
you were hearing. Now, when you say that, that's shocking, because we're saying education, moral education, is necessary for the viability of a republic, and we think immediately of another one of those necessities, and that is the free press. And so you're asking, do we have a free press in this country? You know Jack Palmyre Nelson's book, Nicaragua? He's an old Holdenite, you know, who was here for years. And that is a shocking book on Nicaragua. It notes what I also heard Marvin Kelb. How many know Marvin Kelb? Well, he's at Harvard right now. You know, he was Anchorman and, you know, one of the old commentators in the major networks. But he got out of the business because of the fact that about three banks now owns about 90% of the news media in this country. And you don't have a free press anymore. We don't get the news anymore. And that's a threat to the republic.
Mm-hmm. 17, I heard 17 board of directors control not over 95% of the media.
Yeah. Yeah. And if you look at those boards, you'll find that they have co-membership. It's a very tightly interlocked system. So there's one threat. Now, what are other threats to this critical prophetic voice of the churches in relation to international and domestic issues?
Well, you know, the minute you start saying Tatla, they might think you're unpatriotic. You're not patriotic.
Yep. Not manly, not patriotic.
Yeah, you're not strong enough.
Yep. Yep. Yeah, peace protests with defeat. That's, again, that specter of Vietnam that's not been exorcised. We needed a good one, you know, a real victory. That's so macho and racist, you know. I think what Peter Nash said about racism just cannot be deleted from this question. Don't we ultimately, by our and back to our profligate use of resources, aren't we by our everyday's act claiming that we are worth more than other people on the planet? Just a tacit assumption, unexamined. We don't want to examine it because it would change a lot, wouldn't it? So these are all fairly subtle things, but they all feed into our paralysis to criticize, to analyze, to make decisions in the face of crisis.
I say it was funny how we were fighting one person over there. Mm-hmm. That was Saddam Hussein. According to George Bush, he was fighting him, and I just thought, of all the people that got killed over there, we didn't even think about them. We only were fighting Saddam Hussein, and there was millions of jokes that came around that were, yeah, Saddam Hussein jokes, and it got, so the whole nation got into thinking he was awful, like you did Hitler. Mm-hmm.
Exactly.
You think, how can one person, you know, who came out unscathed in a sense as far as physical injury, had all these hundreds of thousands of people that died for?
Maybe that suggests something else, just occurs to me. We like simple answers. Mm-hmm. Complexity scares us. Ambiguity scares us. If you can name one enemy and it become a duel between George Bush and Saddam Hussein, you got a simple issue. That's an easy one to take care of. Well, as you say, ironically, it wasn't. Gee, for all of our sophistication, we couldn't get rid of him. Mm-hmm. And he's still there, untouched, sowing his terrible seeds of destruction.
Doesn't it seem that that's a connection with the desire for a simple theology, too?
Yeah, exactly. Oh, yes. Just, Clint?
There you have a parallel with the late 19th century, where you have the disastrous experience of the Civil War.
Yeah.
The tremendous threat of immigration, the threat to what was perceived as the Anglo-Saxon theocracy,
yeah,
of the emancipated black in the South and all that represented, and the need for a clear, decisive victory that would set the whole way of thinking right.
Yeah.
And a parallel here with the fragmentation after Vietnam.
It's marvelous, and the difference is that at that time we had a thinker who had a very subtle political and theological system of thought. An Abraham Lincoln, of course, did. You know, remember some of those wonderful statements that in the face of this kind of, again, evangelical triumphalism, he warned that people not identify God's cause with either side.
but rather subject both sides to the scrutiny of divine will. And another statement, in the conflict, it's sure that God is not on both sides, and we better look carefully to see whether, in fact, God is on either side. Now, are we capable of asking that kind of question? But he is remarkable. You're all remarkable. The time is up for that portion, and the tape's going to turn off. But I'd love to discuss further if anyone would like to stay on. Yeah, like Gott mit uns, right? Yeah, boy.
Isn't there on the golf course?
Yeah.
It's so different. A lot of words.
Can you speak louder?
Yeah.
The hostage.
Yeah. Yeah.